seems self-evident now, Kin said, shrugging and sitting back. Did your wife have any relatives? Tracy asked. Strickland shook his head. No, her parents were deceased. How about friends who would have assisted her? I'm not sure anyone did, Strickland said. She had to get from Mount Rainier to Seattle some way, Tracy said. Yes, but she could have rented a car and hidden it somewhere. Did the Pierce County detectives indicate they'd found evidence she'd done so? No, Strickland said, but she could have used her false identity. Again, he looked pleased with his reasoning. Fields was accurate. Strickland believed he was smarter than everybody. Tracy thought Strickland's speculation of a rental car unlikely, but she made a mental note to find out. Assuming she didn't, can you think of anyone who would have assisted your wife? Andrea was an introvert, Strickland said. I was the more outgoing one. She didn't have any friends, Kin said. It wasn't that. It was just that mostly her friends were my friends, our friends. So no close girlfriend who may have helped her, Tracy pressed, wondering why Strickland was being evasive about Devin Chambers. Not that I can think of. I mean, for someone to do that, it's a pretty terrible thing to do to someone. Do you mean to Andrea or to you? Kins asked. To me, he said. They would have had to really hate me to let me go through something like this. I could have spent the rest of my life in jail. What about someone named Devin Chambers? Tracy said. Andrea and Devin worked together, Strickland said, seemingly unflustered. Were they close? I don't know. I think it was more of a work relationship. Did you speak to Devin Chambers after your wife's disappearance? Why would I have done that? Did you speak to her when you learned your wife had walked off the mountain? No. Did you speak to anyone when you received the news? Just Phil. Your wife had a trust, did she not? Yes, Strickland said. It was in excess of $500,000? That's correct. Did you obtain that money after your wife disappeared on the mountain? No, and I have no idea what happened to it. It's gone? Tracy asked. Apparently. And you don't know where it is? I don't. You said you and Andrea loved the outdoors? Tracy asked. We did, Strickland said, though he definitely didn't strike Tracy as the outdoor type. What did you do besides climbing? We hiked quite a bit. Skied in the winter. Water skied? On occasion. Can you drive a boat? Kins asked. Strickland shrugged, meeting Kins's gaze, and in that brief moment letting Kins know he knew exactly where Kins was going, and he had already beaten him there. Just about anyone can drive a boat, he said. After another 30 minutes, Tracy looked to Kins, who gave her a slight shrug. They weren't going to get much more out of Strickland. He was slick, as Fields had warned, and he had Montgomery running interference for him. She thanked both Strickland and Montgomery and handed them a card. If you think of anything that might be helpful, you can reach me at that number. As they left the building, stepping from air conditioning into a quickly warming day, Tracy said, "You knew he didn't own a boat." I just wanted to know if he knew how to drive one, Kin said. Chapter 14. After leaving the DOL, I practiced the name, saying it out loud and in sentences like, "Hi, I'm Lynn Hoff." I drove to Renton, which was on the way back to Portland. I'd found a bank online the previous night called Emerald Credit Union. I stopped in a gas station restroom and applied mascara, eyeliner, and lipstick. I also brushed out my hair and removed my wedding band. Inside the bank, I approached the counter and told the woman I was hoping to open a new bank account. She directed me to 4 desks at the back, divided by cubicle walls. 2 of the desks were empty. A woman who looked to be in her mid-30s sat at the 3rd desk. At the 4th sat a guy who looked about my age, with wisps of hair above his upper lip. The nameplate said, "Branch Manager." I quickly approached. "Hi," I said, smiling brightly. I'm hoping you could help me open an account. He looked up from his computer and smiled. His eyes ran down my body. I knew I looked as good as I ever had, with the weight loss and the workouts in preparation for climbing Mount Rainier.
I'd be happy to, he said.
I just recently relocated, I said, sitting and moving close so that I could lean an arm on the edge of his desk. So I have a temporary driver's license.
That's fine, he said, still smiling.
His gaze dropped for just a brief second to the V in my blouse before re-engaging my eyes.
What brings you to Washington?
Work, I said. My company transferred me here to open an office. I reached out and shook his hand. Lynn Hoff. I liked how the name just rolled off my tongue.
Kevin Gonzalez, he said. I'm the branch manager. What kind of work do you do?
It's an outdoor apparel company, a startup.
What's it called? He asked. Maybe I've heard of it.
Running Free, I said, having thought of the name the night before.
Great name.
He opened his desk drawers and removed paperwork.
How much will you be depositing with us today?
In that account? I paused. Just a few $100. My company will be wiring me additional funds once I provide them with the routing and account numbers, and I'll be making frequent online deposits, probably daily.
We can certainly do that, Kevin said. I noticed you said that account. Will you be opening another account?
I want to also open a personal account, I said. It's quite a bit of money. A settlement from a lawsuit. I was in an accident several years ago. Now that I'm moving here, I want to transfer the funds.
We can certainly accommodate you with that as well, he said. I hope you weren't hurt too badly.
I was in the hospital and rehab for a while, I said.
Well, he said, blushing. You rehabbed nicely, if I can say so, Lynn.
I leaned closer to the desk, allowing my shirt to open just a peak lower. That is so sweet of you, Kevin, I said. Chapter 15. Thursday morning, with a subpoena for Lynn Hoff's bank records tucked into his file, Foz pulled open the car door and slid into the passenger seat, bumping shoulders with Dell as the two of them struggled to pull seatbelts across their bodies. Someone had once commented that Foz and Dell in the front seat of the Ford looked like two grizzlies squished in a circus clown car. Foz just laughed. He and Dell knew they were the comic relief around the violent crimes section, and they embraced that role. They provided a diversion from an often stressful and disheartening profession. After nearly 20 years, Foz knew from experience that detectives witnessed the worst that humanity had to offer, the carnage the sick and depraved left behind. They did not have the luxury the rest of the population had to cover their eyes or look away. They had to rummage through that carnage in the most minute detail, and, when they had finished, when they had put the murderer in jail, they got to do it all over again. There would always be another murder, as sure as taxes and dying, as Foz's mother liked to say. People had been killing one another since Cain killed his brother Abel, since they had been the world's first two births, according to the Old Testament, anyway. And since only Cain had survived, Foz figured the capacity to kill was part of every human being's DNA. When his kids were young, Foz had often struggled with what to tell them he did for a living, about how he spent his day. He'd done his best to shield his sons from the worst of his work, but he couldn't shield himself. His job was to look closely, to try to get into the minds of criminals. He'd hunted serial killers, killers who had dismembered bodies, jealous husbands, and the gangbangers who'd shoot someone over a dime bag of dope. Then he'd driven home, where he was expected to help with the homework and get the boys ready for dinner. Some nights, he'd driven home and sat in the car a block from the house, just trying to make sense of it. Some people asked why he and Dell made jokes. They asked how they could laugh about such things. Foz didn't know. He just knew he would have gone crazy a long time ago if he hadn't found a reason to smile, maybe even a moment of laughter amid the horror.
Some days that was the only thing that made him feel human. Dell pulled into a strip mall that included a teriyaki restaurant, a fitness studio, a UPS store, and the Emerald Credit Union.
"Bank to go," Dell said. "You can eat lunch, work it off, and make a deposit or withdrawal."
"One-stop shopping," Foz said.
Dell maneuvered the car into a spot reserved for bank customers and partially shaded by the building overhang. Since they were 10 minutes early for their appointment, Dell kept the engine running, blasting the air conditioning.
"So why'd she bother to open a corporation?" Dell asked.
"Why go to that trouble?"
The prior afternoon, Foz had run down the account on the receipt Tracy found in the motel room trash. Conversations with the bank manager revealed both a personal account for Lynn Hoff and a business account for a company called Running Free. Foz had looked up Running Free, Inc. on the Secretary of State's webpage, uncertain he'd find anything. Turned out Running Free existed, a subchapter S corporation formed in Delaware in March 2017, 2 months before the Strickland's final excursion up Rainier. The timing further confirmed that Andrea Strickland had planned her disappearance, and she'd been meticulous about it.
"It's one more layer between her and anybody looking for her," Foz said. "You can do all the paperwork online so you can remain anonymous."
"I take it she chose Delaware because they do a lot of business?" Dell asked.
"More companies incorporate there than any other place in the world," Foz said. "You come up with a business name, decide on the type of entity you want to form, pick and designate a registered agent in the state of Delaware from a list, pay a fee, and voila, you get your certificate of incorporation."
"So a safety in numbers sort of thing?"
"Maybe. Although now computers make it easier to track, which I suspect is why she didn't designate herself an officer or shareholder."
"You think the officer's a fake?"
"No doubt. If you need to sign a lease or open a bank account, you say you've been relocated and the company is paying your living expenses. That way, the lease agreements and bills for utilities, which enterprising persons such as us use to track people down, aren't in your name. Another layer of deception. And the name of a company also gives the landlord the warm and fuzzies that they're guaranteed payment, especially if the bank is local."
Dell looked out the window at the glass door entrance to Emerald Credit Union.
"Might be local, but I've never heard of this place. I take it that was also intentional?"
"Easier to make a personal connection with the branch manager and teller at a small bank."
"But I thought the point was not to draw attention to yourself."
"You want to avoid the wrong kind of attention, like going through an airport security checkpoint or customs with a bag full of cash."
"So she dumps it in a bank account," Dell said.
"Not all at once. The banking laws are designed to prevent people from hiding large amounts of cash. Anything over 10 grand and the bank has to fill out paperwork and report it to the feds."
"So she makes sure to make deposits under 10K, Dell said.
"And the feds counted that strategy with the Bank Secrecy Act, which requires a bank to file a report if it suspects a person is making multiple cash deposits to avoid the reporting requirement."
"So you're saying she goes into the local bank and makes nice, so they're less inclined to report her?"
"I'm betting she had a ready-made story to dump that much cash into one account without triggering the reporting requirement."
"So then what? She slowly withdraws the money in that account and deposits it into the business account?"
"Bingo. At the same time, she withdraws money from the business account as if paying business expenses or whatever. But what she's really doing is transferring it to a different account in a different bank in a different name. Layer by layer, it disappears."
"How the hell does a woman with a high school education figure this out?" Dell said, shaking his head.
"You kidding? You can buy books that tell you how to do it step by step."
"Too much trouble," Dell said.
"Yeah, you gotta know how to read."
"Only books I read are on the Civil War," Dell said.
Foz knew Dell had a collection that would make a librarian blush.
"If they had that category on Jeopardy, I'd be on a beach in Greece."
"Greece is bankrupt."
"Exactly. I'd be like a tycoon over there."
Dell killed the engine and checked his watch.
"Let's you and me go figure this out."
Inside the bank, they walked past the 3 bank teller stations to a cluster of 4 desks.
Dell stopped at the obligatory table with styrofoam cups and complimentary coffee and snacks. He snagged a couple of miniature chocolate chip cookies, popping one into his mouth. A female bank employee was waiting on a customer at one of the four desks. The other three desks were empty. On one of those empty desks sat a nameplate holder with a plastic removable sign. Branch manager.
Why is it removable? Dell said.
Maybe it's the guy's name, Foss said.
Dell gave him a look.
Hey, it would save money on business cards.
Foss noticed a gangly young man standing behind the teller station's glance in their direction.
I'll bet that's Branch right there, he said.
The young man took paperwork from a teller and walked to the far end of the bullpen, emerging from a rear door and proceeding to the branch manager's desk.
Detectives?
The young man said, inadvertently drawing the attention of the person seated at the adjacent desk. He lowered his voice, though he would have needed to use sign language to keep the others from hearing. The desks were that close.
I'm Kevin Gonzalez, the branch manager.
Gonzalez looked to be mid to late 20s, but with one of those prepubescent faces still fighting acne, and a wispy mustache that made him look 16. Foss introduced them both. They all took seats.
You have the subpoena?
Gonzalez tried to be all business, then added in an almost apologetic tone, I called the home office and they said you would have a subpoena.
Where's the home office?
Foss asked, hoping a routine question would help Gonzalez relax. The manager was doing his best to look professional, but he couldn't completely hide the nervous shake in his hands or his voice.
Centralia, Gonzalez said, referencing a small town about an hour and a half south of Seattle.
How long has this branch been open?
About 5 years, I believe.
And how long have you been the branch manager?
9 months.
Congratulations.
Gonzalez paused, as if uncertain what to say. Then he smiled.
Thank you.
Did you work here before becoming the branch manager?
Foss asked.
I was a teller for 2 years. Can I offer you some coffee?
We're good,
Foss said.
Makes me sweat in weather like this, Dell added, and I don't need any help in that department.
Foss handed Gonzalez the subpoena. He doubted the young man had ever seen a subpoena before, but Gonzalez took the time to make it appear he knew what he was doing.
We're concerned about the privacy of our customers, Gonzalez said.
Don't be, Dell said. This customer is dead.
Oh.
Gonzalez looked and sounded both surprised and saddened.
Did you know Linhoff? Foss asked.
Yes, Gonzalez said.
He appeared frozen for a moment. He shook free.
Wow, sorry, I opened her accounts.
The personal account and the business account?
Foss said.
Yes.
Tell me about the personal account.
She deposited a large settlement from a car accident, more than $500,000.
Do you remember the day she came in?
Foss asked.
It was March 12th.
No, I mean, do you remember that day?
Foss noted Gonzalez was not wearing a wedding ring and guessed the young man had recalled an attractive young woman like Andrea Strickland.
Oh, yes, sort of.
Tell us what you remember, Dell said, taking out a small spiral notebook and pen.
Gonzalez's gaze flicked to the pad and pen, then back to Foss.
Just that she wanted to open the two accounts. She said she'd been relocated by her business.
Did she say what type of business?
Foss asked.
It was an outdoor apparel company, I believe.
Did she say where she'd moved from?
Somewhere in Southern California, I believe. I remember because she joked about the company having more clients since it rains so much here.
What else do you recall?
Foss asked. Gonzalez glanced away as if trying to remember.
She said she'd just divorced and was tired of the guys in Southern California. She said the whole scene was too superficial for her. She said she was staying with a girlfriend until she found her own place.
And Foss was certain that nugget of well-placed information had piqued Gonzalez's interest, just as Andrea Strickland, a.k.a. Lynn Hoff, had intended it to. High school education, maybe, but she was smart, and she knew how to play the game.
You helped her open the accounts? Foz said.
I did.
How much did she deposit in the business account on her initial visit?
Gonzalez didn't even look at the printed sheets of paper on his desk.
It was just a couple $100.
Did she make any deposits to that account?
Almost daily.
Foz noticed Dell glance at him. He loved being right.
May I? Foz asked.
Gonzalez handed him the sheets of paper. Dell leaned over Foz's shoulder. As Foz had suspected, Strickland had made a steady stream of deposits and withdrawals intended not to draw attention. $1,775, $1,350, $2,260. Over the ensuing month and a half, these small deposits and withdrawals to the business account had increased. The amount of money that had moved through the account had added up to $128,775.42. The Emerald Credit Union was clearly not the only bank account Andrea Strickland had opened. The question was, where had she transferred the rest of the money, and in whose name? Foz was betting the money had gone overseas, to a country that did not report on the identity of its customers. The number that caught his eye, however, was in the far column on the last line, the one indicating Lynn Hoff's balance in both accounts. Zero.
She closed the accounts, Foz said, looking up at Gonzalez. Did she close the accounts?
Apparently.
You didn't close it for her.
She didn't come in.
To open an account, a customer had to personally go into a bank and provide proper identification. That was not necessary to transfer the money and close the account, which could be done electronically, if the person had the account number and password. Foz looked at Dell.
She closed the account June 26th, he said, not bothering to elaborate.
Dell knew it was the Monday after Kurt Schill had pulled Andrea Strickland's body from the depths of Puget Sound. Chapter 16. I got my job back at the insurance company working for Brenda, and that first week back she invited me to lunch to catch up. I think she was worried about me, and, as my surrogate mom, felt it her duty to make sure I was okay. I wasn't, of course. I now fully understood the man I had married. Manipulative, abusive, probably manic-depressive. I knew he would continue to try to take advantage of me, so long as he thought he could gain access to my trust funds. At present he was on his best behavior, but only because he had to be. He had nowhere to go. His job search was not going well. BSBT, not surprisingly, would not provide him with a recommendation. When prospective employers called, BSBT's human resources director declined to comment, which was a law firm's way of saying the ex-employee was incompetent or dishonest without getting sued, and every employer knew it. Graham continued to spin it, saying he didn't want to work for someone else, that the real money was in working for himself. I ignored his comments. Most recently, Graham was talking to a law school roommate who had opened his own firm in a house and was looking for some attorneys to attend depositions and appear in court. Brenda chose a restaurant called the Porthouse, a chic brewery that was so Portland, with plank floors, a tall wood beam ceiling, and brick walls. She had an appointment out of the office and suggested we meet at 1:15 p.m., after much of the lunch crowd had thinned. I removed my sunglasses as I entered, but didn't immediately see her. The hostess led me to a table on the sidewalk patio where I could people-watch while waiting. I pulled up my latest novel on my phone to read. A man's voice interrupted me.
"Excuse me?"
I figured it was a panhandler about to hit me up for change. To my surprise, the man standing on the other side of the small wrought-iron fence wore a suit.
"I'm sorry to bother you," he said, smiling. "I don't normally do this, but if you're not waiting for someone, I wonder if I could buy you a beer."
I was stunned and unsure of what to say. I'd never had anyone pick me up, and I wasn't even sure that was the guy's intent. I know you can't judge a book by its cover, but he seemed so earnest, even a bit sheepish in his approach, like he really never had done this before. Some people give off a vibe, you know.
"I'm sorry," I said. I truly was. I'm having lunch with my friend. But thank you for asking.
He nodded as if he understood my situation, though I'm certain he couldn't have. Maybe it was my vibe. Maybe my vibe was sadness and desperation.
No worries, he said, taking a step back from the fence. I just saw you sitting alone and thought.
The hostess appeared at the table, escorting Brenda.
Well, the man said, nodding to us both. Sorry to interrupt. Have a nice lunch.
Brenda gave me an inquisitive, arched eyebrow.
Friend of yours?
No, I said, watching the man walk away. A part of me wanted to chase after him, tell him I'd love to have lunch, and then we'd talk and I'd realize he was my soulmate. But I knew that was just an age-old fairy tale that had been done a billion different ways in books and movies.
He just wanted to buy me a beer, I said.
She smiled. I don't blame him. You look great. You've lost weight, and you look really toned.
I could again fit into what I referred to as my skinny wardrobe. I felt comfortable. Brenda was casually dressed, casual for her anyway. She wore slacks, a colorful blouse, and a brown jacket she quickly ditched over the back of her chair. For someone who'd just had her first child, she was in phenomenal shape. But then she was obsessed with working out. I knew Brenda was a member of the local YMCA, and, when the weather got nice, she ran. Apparently, she and her husband participated in CrossFit competitions. The waiter arrived.
I'll have a Mac and Jack's, Brenda said.
He looked to me. It was lunch, and Brenda was my boss.
I'll have iced tea.
Nonsense, she said. She'll have what I'm having.
After the waiter departed, Brenda said, The doctor says beer helps produce milk when you're breastfeeding. Who am I to argue? So what have you been doing to look so terrific?
I've been working out, I said, sensing the opening.
Graham wants to climb Rainier. He thinks we need a hobby that will help our relationship.
Are things going better?
When I asked Brenda for my job back, I'd told her we had to file for bankruptcy and that the stress had impacted our marriage.
We're working at it, I said.
Actually, that reminds me I need to get an insurance policy.
An insurance policy?
Life insurance, I said. Graham thinks it would be wise, given the climb is coming up. Could you help?
Sure, she said. So co-policies?
No, just a policy for me.
Her eyes narrowed. Just for you?
Well, we can't really afford the premiums on two policies, and Graham says that if anything were to happen to him, I'd have my parents' trust, so I'd be okay.
So he just wants a policy on you, with him as the beneficiary?
Right.
She seemed to give that some thought. The waiter appeared with our beers. Brenda raised her glass and I met hers across the table. Cheers, she said. It's good to have you back.
Brenda ordered a Caesar salad. The thought of anchovies, even just the smell, almost made me lean over the railing and vomit.
I'll have a house salad with oil and vinegar on the side.
Well, I'm glad things are going better, Brenda said as the waiter departed.
I diverted my gaze.
Andrea, things are going better, right?
A little, I said.
Then I just blurted out.
Actually, I think you might be cheating on me again.
The saddest part might have been Brenda's reaction. She did not look surprised. She set down her glass and reached out a hand to me, her multiple bracelets clattering against the tabletop. How long has it been going on?
Well, the first time was before we were married.
What?
It was an associate in his law firm. He'd been seeing her before he met me and said it had been difficult to break off because he didn't want to hurt her. I'm an idiot, right?
In hindsight, I knew I had ignored all the signs. The late nights, Graham coming home smelling of alcohol, the lack of interest in me except when it suited him. I had been an idiot, but I was no longer going to be an idiot. I had to have a different plan now, and telling Brenda was part of it.
No, she said, looking at me as if I were a broken little bird. Don't blame yourself for this. Have you confronted him about it?
I shook my head.
He'll deny it and turn it around, say I don't trust him.
How did you find out?
I wasn't snooping, I said. I wouldn't do that.
Of course not.
I sat back from the table. It's just that the business was doing so poorly and Graham handled all the business financials. I decided to pay closer attention to the credit card statements. I didn't know where the money was going, or how we were going to pay our bills each month. The expenses were way beyond what the business was generating.
Did you find something on the credit card statements?
I nodded and took a sip of beer.
Graham was making trips to Seattle and to Vancouver and Victoria, and charging the hotel rooms to the company credit cards. There were also restaurant charges and a few bars.
Could they have been business trips? Brenda said, though not with any real conviction.
That's what Graham said.
So you did confront him?
No, that's what he told me when he said he had to leave town for a few days, that they were business trips.
But they weren't?
I called the distributors and dispensaries in Seattle he said he was meeting. They'd never met Graham in person. They had no idea what I was talking about, and pot hadn't been legalized in Canada when he made those trips.
Brenda sighed. Do you know who it is?
No, I said, taking another sip. And then there's the stress that Graham could be going to jail.
Brenda set down her glass. What?
Graham lied on the loan application to the bank. He said he was being made a partner at a higher salary. They asked for a letter to confirm it, and he typed it up on the firm letterhead and forged one of the partner's names.
And the bank found out?
I nodded. They were never going to make Graham a partner. In fact, they'd given him 60 days to find another job. I saw the severance letter. It was right around the time he came home all excited about opening Genesis. He said he wanted to leave the firm because it was stifling his creativity, and he needed to be in business for himself. More bullshit. He said they offered him a partnership, but he was tired of working for someone else and wanted to work for himself. None of it was true.
I'm so sorry for you, Andrea.
Brenda sat back and gave me that look of pity I saw for so many years when my aunt would tell others that my parents were dead.
I know it's early, but do you know what you're going to do?
No,
I said. Would you like to talk to an attorney?
I'd thought that through on my own. I can't afford a divorce, I said.
Brenda's brow furrowed. What do you mean? It should be straightforward. You don't have kids or own a home, and you won't have any significant assets.
Graham signed my name to personal guarantees on the lease of the building and the bank loan.
Why would he do that?
Because he was mad that I wouldn't let him use my parents' trust. We're filing for bankruptcy. I'm really worried I'll lose it and have nothing.
How much is it?
The principal is $500,000, I said.
Brenda's eyes widened. And Graham can't touch it?
Not while I'm still alive, I said, and laughed lightly. And that just makes me angry. What I'm concerned about are the creditors coming after it, saying I signed the guarantees.
Did you have an attorney look at the bank papers?
No, Graham handled it. He said there was no need to pay a lawyer since he was one. I don't know how I would support myself.
She waved it off. Don't worry about that. You can always work for me.
Thanks, Brenda. I hate to bother you with all this.
She reached across the table and again took my hand. It's going to be okay, she said. I'm going to find you an attorney.
Chapter 17. When Tracy called to set up the interview, Brenda Berg explained that she wouldn't be at the office, that she had an infant, a baby girl, and worked from home a couple days a week. Still, Berg never hesitated when Tracy said she and Kins would like to talk to her about Andrea Strickland. She said she'd been following the story of Andrea's brief reappearance and subsequent murder. Tracy reconnected with Berg as she and Kins left Phil Montgomery's office. Berg was about to take her daughter out in the jogging stroller to get her to sleep, but said that if they didn't mind talking and walking at the same time, Berg would meet them near two monuments at Waterfront Park, just below the steel bridge in downtown Portland.
I'll be in workout clothes and pushing a running stroller. Tracy and Kins arrived at the monuments before Berg. The Willamette River was teeming with runners, men and women walking in business attire, and a few baby strollers.
I hope she's not one of those athletic types who walks faster than I run, Kins said, slipping on a pair of sunglasses. My hip is burning from all the time we've spent in the car.
Come on, it's a beautiful day. Maybe a walk will help loosen it up.
I'd like it better if it came with air conditioning.
Tracy spotted an athletic-looking woman in a white tank top, dolphin shorts, and running shoes jogging toward them while pushing a blue stroller with one hand. She slowed as she approached.
Hi, are you Detective Crosswhite?
She didn't look or sound the least bit out of breath. Tracy introduced Kins. Berg looked like a runner, with bony shoulders, lean, sinewy muscles, and a runner's tan. Tracy had been expecting someone younger, given that Berg said she had a newborn, but the crow's feet at the corners of Berg's eyes indicated she was more likely late 30s to early 40s, Tracy's age.
"Sorry to do this to you," Berg said, leaning down to peek into the stroller. "But she's off on her sleep cycles, and this seems to be the only way to get her to nap in the afternoon."
"Not a problem," Tracy said. Tracy looked beneath the canopy that provided the baby shade. The little girl lay wrapped in a pink blanket and wore a light blue beanie.
"How old is she?"
5 months yesterday," Berg said.
"She's beautiful."
"Thanks. We named her Jessica. She's my angel."
Tracy smiled at the tiny face beneath the beanie, and it stirred her own memories. She'd always imagined she'd have children. She'd imagined that she'd live next door to Sarah, and they'd raise their kids together.
"Do you have other children?" she asked.
"No," Berg said, still smiling at her daughter. "I was more into building my insurance practice and making a living. I met my husband a couple years ago. It took a while before we decided to pull the trigger. Now, I don't know what my life would be like without her. Do you have kids?"
"No," Tracy said.
"Wedded to your job, I'd imagine."
"Something like that," Tracy said.
She'd been wedded to finding out who had killed Sarah, and it had come at a cost. She'd lost a husband, left a career teaching in Cedar Grove to join the Seattle Police Department, and rarely dated. For years she'd spent most nights going over manuscripts and pieces of evidence related to her sister's disappearance, until she'd hit a dead end and reluctantly boxed up her work. By then she was in her mid-30s, and her dating prospects seemed to be cops or prosecutors, and she wasn't interested in bringing her work home any more than she already did.
"I know that feeling," Berg said.
As if on cue, Jessica made a noise, and Berg added, "We better get moving. Seems to be the only thing that puts her to sleep." They walked the pavement, Tracy at Berg's side, Kins following a step behind.
"I'm still in shock," Berg said. "This was horrible the first time. I mean, when we thought Andrea died 2 months ago. Now, finding out she was alive? I don't know what to think."
She looked to Tracy.
"So, she's dead? She really is the woman found in that crab pot?"
"That appears to be the case," Tracy said, stepping to the side as two runners approached and passed. Berg shook her head.
"My emotions are all screwed up."
"I take it from your response that you hadn't heard from Andrea," Tracy said.
"No, not a word."
"How long did she work as your assistant?"
"About 2.5 years. She left for about 7 months when she and her husband opened their business. When it failed, she came back."
"Was it strictly a professional relationship?" Tracy asked.
Berg nodded. "Andrea was quite a bit younger, and there was that natural demarcation between employer and employee, but we'd occasionally go out to lunch, that sort of thing. I kind of decided that she needed someone. You know, she lost her parents at a very young age."
"We know," Tracy said.
"It was tragic. She didn't talk about it, but it came out in her interview, and I looked it up. Her parents died in a car accident on Christmas Eve. A drunk driver hit them. From what I understand, Andrea was trapped in the car. I tried to be there for her when she needed me."
"What kind of person was she?" Tracy asked.
"Andrea was quiet, but not necessarily shy.
People thought she was shy because she read a lot. That was my first impression, too.
What did she read? Tracy asked.
Novels, Berg said. She had paperbacks stacked all over her desk, novels on her phone and her Kindle. She read all the time. But when you got to know her, you realized she wasn't shy. She just preferred not to be the center of attention. She liked to stay on the periphery. Does that make sense?
Can you give me an example? Tracy said.
Berg gave the question some thought. We had a function at the company, a birthday party for someone. I caught Andrea sitting back and taking everything in, you know? If you didn't know her, you might get the impression she was disinterested. But if you watched her closely, you'd see these little grins or frowns, or maybe a subtle eye roll. It was never blatant or disrespectful. Just enough that I knew she was paying attention.
Was she intelligent? Tracy asked.
Very, Berg said, nodding.
You sound certain of that.
For someone without any college education, she was extremely quick to pick things up. She wasn't a normal assistant. I'd give her some fairly complex tasks, and she'd get the work done in no time flat. I think she was just one of those people who was inherently very smart, very gifted. Maybe from all the reading she did. You never had to instruct her twice. I was encouraging her to go to college or to get her insurance license.
They approached a second drawbridge. Out on the water, speedboats zipped by with young men and women in bathing suits.
"Did you know her husband, Graham?" Kins asked.
Berg looked back over her shoulder. "A little. I was inadvertently to blame for that."
"How so?" Kins said.
"Like I said, Andrea was an introvert. She really just preferred to go home and read after work. It became my mission to find her a social life. We had a function downtown, and I sort of forced Andrea to attend. That's where she met Graham. Anyway, next thing I knew, she's getting married."
"How long after they met?" Tracy asked.
Berg blew out a breath. "It was fast, I'll tell you that. Maybe a month or two? I'm not really sure."
"Did Andrea seem happy?"
"Hard to tell with Andrea. She kept everything so close to the vest, but I thought so."
"We understand she grew up in Southern California. Do you know if she still has family down there?" Kins asked.
"An aunt, I believe, though I don't think they're close."
"Did you subsequently get to know Graham?" Kins asked.
"Not real well," Berg said. "For the most part, Andrea kept her work life and personal life separate."
Tracy deduced from the tone of Berg's response that she had not been a fan of Graham Strickland, but was being diplomatic.
"But you had occasion to meet him?"
"Just a couple of times. He came to a few functions, and every so often he'd come in and pick up Andrea from work."
"What was he like?" Kins said.
Berg smiled, but it looked like more of a wince, as if she were in pain. She looked like someone who had an opinion but didn't want to offer it.
"We understand you didn't know him very well," Tracy said.
"We're just looking for your general impression of him." "Honestly, I didn't care for him." She again hesitated. "He was just one of those guys who tried too hard. Do you know what I mean?"
"Tried too hard to be liked," Kins said.
Berg again looked back over her shoulder, but this time she paused mid-step and stopped.
"Yes, that's a very good way to put it."
"What did he do?" Kins asked.
"It was just everything. The way he dressed, his hair, the beard. It was all affected, like he was trying to display a certain image. And the Porsche." She smiled and shook her head at the thought of it. "A red Carrera Porsche. It was all just sort of obnoxious, and I don't think he was any rocket scientist."
"Why not?" Tracy ased.
"Just little things," Andrea said. "Like the marijuana dispensary. Andrea tried to tell him she didn't think it was a good business idea, but she said Graham had done all the research and told her it was going to be a gold mine."
Tracy wiped a bead of perspiration trickling down the side of her face. She could feel sweat between her shoulder blades from the sun, which was at their backs. "Did Andrea ever say she and Graham were having marital troubles?" Berg became contemplative.
"Andrea and I went to lunch after she came back to work for me, after the business failed. She said Graham was cheating on her."
"Did she say with who?" Tracy asked.
She didn't know, but apparently it wasn't the first time. He'd cheated with someone he used to work with.
How'd she find out? Did she say? Tracy asked.
When the business started to fail, she paid closer attention to the expenses and found credit card charges for hotels and restaurants in Seattle. He'd said they were related to work, but she called the businesses. They weren't.
So, she was resourceful, Kin said.
When she had to be, Berg said.
What else did she tell you at that lunch? Tracy asked.
Berg shook her head. In hindsight, I wish I had done something more.
About what?
Andrea said that despite the marital problems, Graham wanted to climb Mount Rainier.
He wanted to climb it?
Kins asked. That's what she said. She told me that Graham said it would help if they had a hobby, something they could do together. Then she said he also mentioned taking out a life insurance policy, but only on her.
Only her?
Tracy asked, giving Kins a sidelong glance. I know. I thought it sounded odd at the time, but Andrea said they couldn't afford the premiums on both, and Graham reasoned that if anything happened to him, she could live off her trust. You know about her trust, right?
We do,
Tracy said. It struck me as odd at the time, you know, but you don't think about these types of things.
So what was your first thought when you heard Andrea had disappeared from Mount Rainier? Kins asked.
Berg hesitated. The baby fussed, and she took a moment to soothe her daughter, inserting a pacifier in the baby's mouth. When they started walking again, she said, I guess I was skeptical.
Skeptical that it was an accident? Kins asked.
She nodded. Let me put it this way. I wasn't surprised Graham was a suspect, and I wouldn't have been shocked if they'd concluded he killed Andrea. I told the other detective the same thing.
Stanfield's? Tracy asked.
I don't remember his name. He had a gray ponytail. I told him it all just seemed too convenient. Then there was something Andrea told me about her parents' trust. She said Graham wanted to use the money to help set up the dispensary rather than take out a business loan, but Andrea wouldn't let him, and there were restrictions on the trust that prevented it.
Did she say it was causing strain in their marriage? Tracy asked.
It was pretty clear that was the case.
Did she tell you that?
Yes.
She told you she didn't want to give him the money? Kins asked, sounding out of breath.
Berg nodded. She said Graham got upset about it, and that he had forged her name on personal guarantees. She feared he'd put the trust at risk. But what really should have set off my radar was something Andrea said when I asked whether Graham had access to the trust.
What did she say? Tracy asked.
She said, not while I'm still alive.
Berg shook her head at the memory.
She laughed, but it had a sad quality to it, you know? I felt sad for her. Sad that she would say such a thing.
They crossed beneath another bridge. When was the last time you saw or spoke to Andrea? Tracy said.
It was that week she left to climb.
What was her mood like?
Berg said. It wasn't always easy to tell with Andrea. I mean, she was pretty even-keeled. I think she'd experienced a lot of sorrow in her life at a young age, and it had made her, I don't know, maybe more measured about life. Like maybe she didn't expect much.
Jaded, Kin said.
That's as good a word as any, Berg said, glancing back at him. Even when she married Graham, I didn't get a sense she was elated about it. Just more sort of like, this is how it was.
Did Andrea have any girlfriends, people she hung out with, maybe went out with after work?
The only person I can really think of is Devin Chambers. She worked in the office for one of my partners, and she and Andrea seemed close. Other than that, not really.
Does Devin Chambers still work at your company?
No, she left right about the time Andrea died, or when we all thought Andrea had died. The first time.
Did she leave because of that?
I don't know. She didn't talk to me about it. She told my partner she was moving back east somewhere. I think she had family.
Tracy looked to Kins, who shook his head to indicate he had no further questions.
Thank you again for your time, Tracy said. We'll let you and your daughter finish your run.
She handed Berg a business card. If you think of anything else, don't hesitate to call.
As Tracy and Kins walked along the waterfront, back in the direction of the sculptures, Tracy said, "Does it strike you as odd that a woman who believed her husband was cheating on her for at least the second time in a year would agree to climb Mount Rainier with him?"
"Even more so if she was talking to a divorce attorney," Ken said. "Sounds to me like she was planning on walking off and starting over."
Tracy stopped. "Maybe it's like Berg said. Maybe there was more to Andrea Strickland than initial impressions."
"Sounds like it," Kin said, "though I'm not certain what that means yet."
What if this wasn't just about disappearing and starting over?
"You think it was her way of getting even? She set him up to make it look like he wanted to kill her?"
Kin said. Berg said Andrea believed he was cheating on her, and it wasn't the first time.
"So our theory is what? The husband realizes she'd set him up, hunts her down, and kills her to get even?"
"Not just to get even. To get what he was after in the first place."
"The money," Kin said.
"She's already dead," Tracy said. "He figures that if he finds her, he finds the money. Since she's already dead, no one is the wiser. He just needs a way to dispose of the body so she'll never be found."
"Okay, but how do we prove it?" Kin said.
"I think we need to find Devin Chambers. If Andrea was going to confide in anyone, it sounds like it would have been her."
"You think that's why Chambers left town? That maybe she was the person who helped her?"
"Ranger Hicks is convinced Andrea Strickland didn't get off the mountain alone," Tracy said.
"Then I'd also like to talk to the aunt," Kin said. "Being dead has to get lonely, and it sounds like she was her only family."
Tracy called Stan Fields on the drive back to police headquarters to discuss Devin Chambers. She put him on speakerphone.
"Did you know she's left town?" Tracy asked. "No, but no crime in that." "Why? You think they could have been dykes or something?"
Tracy rolled her eyes while Kins stifled a laugh.
"No, but it's possible if Andrea confided in her that they remained in touch." "She told me she didn't know much of anything."
"Did you ever come across any evidence the husband was having another affair?"
"The employer mentioned that. She said the wife was convinced he was cheating on her, but she didn't have any details. I spoke to the associate at the law firm he'd been hammering, and it wasn't her. She said the first time had been a mistake, that she didn't know he'd gotten married, and she was married and had moved on, hadn't seen or talked to him in months."
"Okay, so you haven't followed up with Devin Chambers?"
"Like I said, I had no reason to. She had receipts indicating she was out of town when they climbed. You have something different?"
"I don't know," Tracy said.
"It's your rodeo, detective. Have at her if you think there's something there."
Tracy hung up. "I really don't like that guy."
"He's a cowboy," Kin said, smiling.
"He's a jackass." Tracy let a few miles pass, thinking again of Brenda Berg and her baby. Kins had three boys. "You glad you had kids, Kins?"
Kins looked over at her. "It got to you, didn't it?" "I figured it did."
"What?" she said, sounding defensive.
"Berg and you are about the same age and have a lot of similarities."
"We don't have that many similarities."
"Oh, no?"
"So are you glad?" she asked. Kins gave it some thought.
"Not when they crash the car or tell me the night before that they have a report due," he smiled.
"But the other 99% of the time?"
"Yeah, I'm glad." "Does Dan want to have kids?"
"I'm 43, she said, wondering if she'd waited beyond her window.
"I know a woman who was 42 when she had her first. She has two now."
"They're healthy?"
"From what I know. Have you talked to Dan about it?"
"Yeah, a little bit. But a part of me wonders if his willingness is just because I'm asking. Neither of us is young." Kins frowned.
"People make a big deal about having kids when they're young. Let me tell you, that's not always a good thing. I've a lot more patience now than I did when I was 25, and patience is a big part of being a parent."
"I used to think I'd have kids in my 20s.
Now I look back and think I was still a kid in my 20s, at least until my sister died. Things changed after that. It wouldn't have been fair to have kids then. I was too busy trying to find out what had happened to her. She looked at Kins, who, other than Dan, was her closest friend. So you don't think I'd be too old, huh? You don't think I'd show up at grammar school and have people thinking I was the grandma?
So what if they did?
I'd be over 60 before he or she turned 20.
Yeah, well, I'm not looking forward to having an empty nest in my mid-40s either. I don't know what the hell Shanna and I are going to do. My kids are the best part of my life.
I hope you didn't tell Shanna that.
Hey, I'm old, I'm not stupid.
Okay, here's what I think.
Call it Kins 101. When we didn't have kids, we adapted, right? When we had kids, we adapted. When the kids are grown and out of the house, we'll adapt again. Age doesn't play into any of that. If you love Dan and you want kids, I say go for it. You'd be better parents than 99% of the knuckleheads out there.
Tracy smiled.
Grandma, Ken said.
You're such an ass, Tracy said, laughing. Tracy watched Foz spike his fork in the Tupperware bowl on his desk and struggle out of his desk chair as soon as he spotted her and Kins returning. Ordinarily, Foz was like a dog with a bone when it came to Vera's leftovers. He did not forsake them without good reason. It meant he had something of interest to tell them.
"You speak to the bank?" she said, over the sound of indeterminable voices from the other three bullpens. She set her purse on her chair, smelling the garlic from Vera's cooking, knowing the smell would linger all day.
Lynn Hoff told the branch manager she worked for an outdoor apparel company and would be making regular cash deposits, Foz said. She also opened a personal account and deposited over $500,000, said it was an injury settlement. For the next several weeks, she made daily deposits into and withdrawals out of the business account that corresponded with the withdrawals from her personal account.
Kin smiled at Tracy.
Looks like we found her trust funds.
She was washing them, Foz said, probably moving the money out of the country.
I assume the hubby knew about the trust, Dell said from his cubicle.
Makes for a hell of a motive if he did.
No doubt, Kin said.
But that's not the news, Foz said, looking and sounding like a man with a secret.
The news is someone emptied the accounts first thing Monday morning, after Shill pulled her body up in the pot.
Kins glanced at Tracy before turning back to Foz.
How could someone even do that?
You have to be physically present to open an account, Foz explained.
Not to close it. Whoever did it online. But that means they had to know the bank, the names on the accounts, and the passwords.
Tracy looked to Kins. Everything was coming together, and it was all pointing to Graham Strickland.
The husband?
Devin Chambers, Kins said.
Who's Devin Chambers? Foz asked.
Andrea Strickland's friend, Tracy said. We're going to need to run her down.
Can we find the money where it went? Kins asked.
I got the fraud unit looking into it, Foz said. But I'm betting the person immediately routed the money out of the country to a quaint little bank that doesn't ask a lot of information.
If the person knew what they were doing, Tracy said, wondering how they could prove that person was Graham Strickland. Computer records? Phone records?
Based on what I've seen so far, they did, Foz said. At least she did when she was still alive. If it hadn't been for the timing of the withdrawals, I would have said it was her, that she'd thought this whole thing through.
Except the part about her getting killed, Dell said.
Yeah, well, Foz said.
Johnny Nolasco walked into their bullpen. His appearance had the same effect as a parent walking into a room full of teenagers. Everyone stopped talking. He looked to Tracy.
I didn't get a statement for the brass or the PIO, he said.
We had interviews early this morning down in Portland.
I could have saved you the drive, Nolasco said. Pierce County prosecutor is reasserting jurisdiction.
What? Tracy said.
thinking they were just making progress, and now Pierce County was trying to pull the case back?
Call came in about an hour ago.
Who made that decision? Tracy asked.
Someone higher up the food chain than me.
What was their